Remember the good old days before Microsoft Word had autosave? You'd type up some important document and then your computer would freeze and you'd lose hours of work just because you forgot to hit save? Well, that's what it's like going online without ExpressVPN. Every time you're connected to an unencrypted network, whether it's in an airport, a hotel, a cafe, or anywhere, your online data is not secure. Any person on that same network who knows what they're doing can gain access to your personal data. Bank logins, credit card details, passwords, all the stuff you don't want people seeing. Unfortunately, hacking has become much easier than it used to be. People don't even have to be exceptionally skilled to do it, and there's a lot of money to be made by selling your information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. It's incredibly easy to use. Once the app is running, you literally click one button to get protected. And it works on your phone, laptop, tablet, and more, so you can stay protected on the go. I've been using ExpressVPN for a little while now, and I can rest easy knowing my info is safe and secure. I've heard horror stories of people who've been hacked, and it sounds like a massive pain to try to get any resolution in the aftermath, so I am not interested in finding out what that process is like. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/film.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, June 17th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to talk a little bit about the House of the Dragon Season 2 premiere, and we're also going to present an interview with showrunner Ryan Condal. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, we don't really need to have like a big conversation or anything because you talked about the show very recently on the podcast and your review is up on slashfilm.com. I will link to that in the show notes as well. But I watched the premiere last night. That's all that I've seen so far from season two. I think you've had screeners for a few upcoming episodes as well. But I am like tentatively back in on the show. I know I was like a little hesitant about returning to this world. And in this premiere episode that aired last night, there were a few characters and a few plot lines where I was like, wait a second, what the hell is going on? Because I did not rewatch the first season or anything. I was just curious about your experience watching this. Like, did you retain all of the details and dynamics between, you know, about these characters and stuff when you went in to watch season two? Or did you have to do like a refresh? Or what was your experience like there?
Oh, I was completely... didn't remember a thing. It's been 2 years since season one, and I was just trying to remember, who is that? Who's the father of who? Like, how are they connected again? I was absolutely doing that, which is why if you actually look at slashfilm.com, we have I think three articles essentially recapping all the important stuff from season one. That was like my first marching order with a team. I was like, okay, we got to make sure if people want this information, it's out there. So
yeah,
if you're wondering why we have a complete guide to Team Black, a complete guide to Team Green, and also a complete list of everything you forgot from season one, these are all on slashfilm.com, and I would highly recommend reading them ahead of watching the season two premiere if you have not, you know, rewatched or revisited season one in any way, because yeah, it definitely does launch you in there in a kind of unforgiving fashion. And I know part of that is due to the strikes, but also part of it is just the length and production of a season of TV is expensive. Just means, you know, longer wait between seasons. So at the same time, here's my question for you, Ben. Would you prefer that a show like slow down and recap itself, or would you rather it kind of just get to the meat and assume the viewer is ready to go along with it?
I think this premiere actually struck a pretty decent balance. Like the previously on recap that HBO provided at the beginning of the episode was enormously helpful, just by, you know, showing those quick flashes of like, oh, okay, getting, you know, acclimating me back into that world. And of course, like the big dragon death that happened in the finale of season one, or at least at the very end of that season, was sort of the inciting incident for season two. So it felt like this show took place almost in like the immediate aftermath of that. And so that was helpful enough. And then I feel like for the most part, I was able to track things. There was some stuff still, like the, I think they call her the white worm, maybe, that yeah. Character. I'm going to have to go back and read our explainers and stuff, because like, I don't remember anything that she did in season one, but for the most part, I think this, the pacing I actually was on board with, so far in season two anyway. And I really, really liked what happened, at the very end of the show. I mean, of course it was terrible, and I'm trying to be vague here. It's horrifying, but like the way that, the show really seemed to be not taking too much time and not like lazily walking us back in, it really like kicks things off with the end of that episode. I'm guessing what's coming next is going to start coming fast and furious, you know, like the consequences of that are going to be, I have to imagine, are going to be pretty huge.
Yeah. I won't spoil anything, but I have seen the first four episodes, and episodes one and two do a really good job of shifting a lot of pieces around. And then episodes three and four are those pieces colliding in ways that are horrifying and extremely entertaining. if you do happen to think that this episode was a little slow, is weird, because binging these episodes for work, I felt it was a slow start that like was that paid off tremendously with episodes three and four of this season. But the reaction so far from other folks who are just watching individually have been that episode one didn't feel slow at all. So I don't know what I was on watching the screener. Maybe it's because I didn't have the previously on recaps and I was struggling a little bit, because the screeners don't have those.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad the show's back, and I'm glad I talked to Ryan Condal, the showrunner. He's he was the co-showrunner on the season one. Now he's running the show solo, and we had 10 minutes, and I wish we had more time, because he's clearly a Game of Thrones fan. Like, I brought up that, you know, hey, I really like dragons, and I like big battle scenes, but do you know what I really love? I love small councils. I love people sitting around tables, like, whispering at each other, and he, like, totally got that. So in an interview, you'll hear us talk about small council meetings and about trying to balance the Team Black versus Team Green. And also, I asked them about the recent George R. R. Martin comments. Did you hear that George R. Martin blog post that kind of went mini-viral last month?
What was it?
He wrote a blog post where he said, didn't mention any names, but went on a, I guess, a bit of a rant about how most adaptations do not honor the book, and how writers tend to go off on their own thing and try to put their own mark on great material when they adapt, as opposed to adapt it. And never specifically mentions any names or titles, but naturally people kind of picked up and ran with it to make certain assumptions, you know, either healthy or unhealthy, about certain shows that may or may not be based on George R. R. Martin material. So I asked Ryan Condal about that, and if George R. R. Martin, who's actually been actively involved in development of House of the Dragon, has shared these reservations with him in any capacity. So we talked about that as well. So I think it's a good, good combination of us geeking out about, you know, small council, but also talking about, you know, the responsibility of adaptation.
Excellent. All right. Well, here is your conversation with Ryan Condal.
Hi. Congratulations on the season. The first few episodes are great. Oh, thanks. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. So I want to talk about adapting Fire and Blood. You know, it's a fake history book. It's full of alternate takes. It's full of people who disagree. It's full of a lot of mysteries. So you're making the definitive version of those events. So I want to know, especially after you've gotten your foothold in season one, what is the process of deciding what is the actual version of a like ambiguous event from that story? Like, what is the process for determining the truth?
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't know that we're making the definitive version. I think, we're trying to make an objective story, a version of the history that, because it's television, so we're not making Rashomon here, so we have to pick a lane with it. And what I think we're really trying to do is keep the show an active conversation with the book. And I think my hope is, and has always been from the beginning, if you've read the book and then you watch the series enriches your enjoyment of the book because you get to see how those things interact. And the same for people that go in the other direction. If you see the series and then you go back and read the book, it enhances your enjoyment of the series because you see, oh, for instance, Damon's wife in the book is just mentioned as at some point of having fallen off her horse and having her skull crushed. And then you realize that in our take in the story was that, Damon had a hand in that. And the way the two things interact with each other. But we very much looked at the book as this is a version of the history. It's a version with an agenda. There are these three male accounts of this time period about two women and fighting their families fighting over the throne. And the book is put together by another male, the Archmaester Gildane, who's collecting it. And what are the agendas in play there? And are they trying to give a true accounting of the history, or are they trying to set the record straight and for the people that read this in the years to come? And we obviously have to pick a path through it. So I think we go for the thing that feels the most true to the characters as we've written them for the television show, as they've been embodied by the wonderful actors that play them. And the thing that, I don't know, feels the most dynamic and interesting, because while the book is there and we draw from it regularly, it's the well that we draw from. I think we are looking to try to put spin on it sometimes that brings about the historical events as rendered in the history, but in an interesting and unexpected way.
I want to talk about balancing allegiances because the marketing and is Team Black versus Team Green, but it's the show keeps you on your toes because I think very clearly in my heart I'm Team Black, but in my head I'm Team Green. I think one makes sense for a safe nation, one makes sense for what I want to see. So I want to know, I don't want to ask you Team Black or Team Green, but as a writer, how do you maintain that balance where you're making people like me question our allegiances like that episode to episode?
Well, I think that's a great take on it, Jacob. I think that's the kind of things that I think we as writers want to hear about the story. It's less sort of, like, do you root for Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader? I think those things are less interesting. For me, it's always about the individuals on either side. And I think hopefully we've created a complex enough tapestry that you can find empathy and sympathy with characters on either side of the conflict, and also characters that you loathe and don't want to see in power on either side of the conflict. So it's really a left, I hope the audience is left wondering, do I really want to see either side come out of this in total victory? And what does that mean for the realm, and what does that mean for the subjects and the small folk in the kingdom, and who what at what cost are we going to see this throne won in the end of this, if such a thing is to happen?
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
So I know you often get asked about the big battle scenes and the scope of everything and the dragons, and I appreciate and love all of that. I know it's especially a show like this needs to have that scope, but every single time I sit down with my team to discuss the show, it's about the small council scenes. We like people sitting around a table, conniving, pushing things around maps. What is the key to creating a great small council scene, and why do freaks like me love them so much?
No, I love it. I'm one of those. We love writing them. I think that was the thing that I loved about early Game of Thrones, that as the war gets bleaker and bleaker and most of the people standing around those tables were dead, I think it was the thing that I missed the most about the simpler days when everybody was strategizing instead of, you know, running from the Walking Dead. I think the making of a great small council scene is certainly conflict and differing points of view. You don't want a scene where it's just a bunch of people reporting the news. You want a scene where you have counselors that are trying to manipulate or navigate the sovereign sitting at the head of the table into a certain decision as they see it. And it's interesting whether it's Rhaenyra or whether it's Aegon, who obviously approach their council very differently. But I think that's what makes for a dynamic room. And you want every voice at the table to have a specific position and point of view and a way that they're setting about their pursuit of the Game of Thrones and the way that they're plucking at the marionette strings. And I think when you have a dynamic where things are working on multiple levels, then that's when you have one of those council meetings that's really singing.
So earlier you compared it all to a tapestry. So I got to make the obvious segue here. The new opening credits, are they going to change every season? Or is this what was the reason for changing? I really like them. Actually, I think I prefer the tapestry look. I'd buy that tapestry if HBO released it. So what's up with that?
Good to know. It was after a lot of discussion, and obviously this would be post airing of episode one discussion. I felt like the sort of ancestral credits were correct for season one, the idea of this bloodline and family tree. But this story now in season two, now that all that stuff has kind of been set and established and entrenched, it felt more like we were watching a living history. And my feeling was continuing to follow the Targaryen family tree now that we're in real time. And really, I mean, maybe there will be some children born as we move forward from here into the future. It sort of that story had been set. But again, we're watching this living history as it unfolds. So it felt more interesting to see that dramatized in the way that histories were kept back in the Middle Ages, which was with beautiful tapestries. So I think you'll see as the season goes, you'll see a bit of evolution in that version of the story we're telling. But I think these are the credits as we go from here to the end.
So. Recently, George R. R. Martin made headlines when he discussed adaptations and how he seemed very displeased with how a lot of people approach adaptations. And some people made some bad faith judgment calls in those headlines. I'm not prepared to go there. But I'm wondering if he's ever talked to you about his feelings on adaptations and what his pitfalls were as you've taken those into account.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've talked about it certainly before, and he has very specific opinions on various, I think, texts that, you know, you and I probably care about, you know, a lot as well, and how they're brought to the film, to the screen. And I think he approaches it from the point of view as a book author, who is the, you know, sort of creator of the source material. But it's interesting because he's also, as everybody knows, was a TV writer for, many years in his past. So I think he's lived the life of the creator and the adapter a bit. And, Look, he has his opinions, and I certainly respect all that. I think the challenge of bringing any adaptation to life is trying to find the through line through the source material that makes it appropriate and relevant for a TV audience, and taking into account whatever is going on in the world and the themes that we're interested in pulling on and how to bring those things to life. You know, I think Shogun is a great example of something that was a modernized and updated take recently on a revered book that really landed and did well. So I think adaptations can kind of take on their own life based on the not just how the story is adapted, but the quality of the adaptation.
So I feel I can't imagine being in your shoes. You're making a show that some people are watching, and some people are ready to be loud about and ready to make their opinion known. Whether it's people at the at HBO or on the internet or in conversation. So, but was there a moment during in the aftermath of season one where you felt like there was a lesson learned or a comment somebody made where you said, that's actually really good, I want to do that in season two? I'm curious if there was something that you adapted to like that.
I don't think necessarily. I mean, I'm not on social media. I really do try to stay out of all that, because, and it was a decision I made when I got this job, because I didn't want that noise to be in my head in a way to certainly not affect anything I was doing artistically or creatively, but also I just didn't want to be haunted by the multitude of voices of the internet. I think it's a potentially dark path to go down when you're doing something that's as high profile as this. Mm-hmm. But no, I think, the thing I think I was most impressed about with this general audience response in season one, and this is in talking to people and also in talking to other people that work on the show that do pay attention to what's going on online, is how sophisticated the audience is and how smart they are, and how we, through 20 years of history with 16 names that sort of sound similar and with multiple bloodlines and with sort of weird and also incestual bloodlines, and somebody's a husband and also an uncle, and how they all kind of bought into it and followed it through a major recasting at the middle of the season. And I think that was it. I think it was just realizing just how seasoned and sophisticated the audience was, and knowing that you could trust them with complicated storytelling.
You felt you can be bolder and braver rather than have to retreat in any way.
Exactly.
All right. Well, tell me about time. Thank you so much. Hope the rest of your day goes smoothly.
Thanks, Jacob.
All right, Jacob, is there anything else that you can tease in some way for what's coming up on the season without really like spilling the beans too much and giving things away in a big way?
Oh, I don't want to tease anything, because it's just really, really good. I wrote this about a review. I think I mentioned this in our last conversation. I don't think I love House of Dragons characters in the way I loved Game of Thrones characters. Like, there's no Tyrion or Arya who, like, I'm ride or die for. But the plotting of this season and the clockwork way in which one poor decision escalates into another and the dominoes collide in ways that are increasingly horrifying is just an absolute pleasure to watch. I mean, if you like slow motion train wreck drama, which, Game of Thrones did well too, that's what House Dragon season two is. It's just watching two trains heading for each other, and you're not rooting for either train. At least I'm not. I just want both trains to miss each other, but they're not. And that's kind of the intense, horrible pleasure of House of the Dragon, is knowing that nobody gets out of this okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm still like, my biggest reservation about the show is what we talked about before with that same thing, where like, I'm not really in love with any of these characters. And like, I guess I'm just going to have to come to grips with that and like realize that that's going to be the standard for this series, I think, unless they start introducing new characters along the way. I'm not really sure what the plan is for how long the show is supposed to run or anything. I know it got renewed for season three already. But if you got like a Pedro Pascal type or somebody like that who like breezes into the show in the next season or something, or maybe even late in the season, and like livens things up in a way, like there's opportunities for me to fall in love with new characters in this world. But I just don't think any of these characters, any of these folks that we've been spending a lot of time with in season one and in this premiere, are like the ones that I'm gonna ever get to ride or die stage for. So we'll have to rely on the plotting to get us through, but at least from what you're saying, it sounds like it's super entertaining to watch along the way. So I'm excited. Yes,
I will say, Ben, as a Slow Horses fan, Freddie Fox, who played Spider on Slow Horses, does join this season very shortly, so at least you get another
Okay, that's interesting. All right, well, that has me maybe perking up a little bit, so we'll have to see how that goes. But yes, House of the Dragon season two, the premiere is up on Max right now. New episodes come out on Sunday nights on HBO, and I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much, much more about House of the Dragon season two at slashfilm.com. I will link to a bunch of the things that Jacob mentioned in the show notes for this episode, so you can find those really easily that way. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
When you have to stop but don't really want to, stop at BP. Because BP has everything you need to keep it going. Fuel to keep the adventures going. The BP Me app to keep the savings and the commutes going. Snacks and drinks to keep the crew going. And the BP Me Rewards Visa to keep the rewards going and going and going. A stop at BP isn't a stop at all. Keep it going.